All right, well, we are in chapter 45. Just flirting with chapter 50, aren't we? We're getting there. We're getting there. All right, then we're going to read the entire chapter.
43 or
45? 45. Hear the word of the Lord. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." And so no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near me, please." And they came near, and he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land for these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. And so it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children, and your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will provide for you, for there are yet 5 years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my honor in Egypt and of all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here.' And then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept on them. And after that, his brothers talked with him. And when the report was heard in Pharaoh's house, 'Joseph's brothers have come,' it pleased Pharaoh and his servants. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Say to your brothers, do this, load your beasts and go back to the land of Canaan and take your father and your households and come to me. And I will give you the best of the land of Egypt and you shall eat the fat of the land. And you, Joseph, are commanded to say, do this, take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives and bring your father and come. I have no concern for your goods, for the best of all of the land of Egypt is yours.' The sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh and gave them provisions for the journey. To each and all of them, he gave a change of clothes, but to Benjamin he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 changes of clothes. To his father he sent as follows: 10 donkeys loaded with the good things of Egypt and 10 female donkeys loaded with grain, bread, and provision for his father on the journey. Then he sent his brothers away, and as they departed, he said to them, 'Do not quarrel on the way.' And so they went up out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan, to their father Jacob. And they told him, 'Joseph is still alive, and he is ruler over all the land of Egypt.' And his heart became numb, for he did not believe them. But when they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, and the spirit of their father Jacob revived, and Israel said, 'It is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die.'" Thus ends the reading of God's holy word. Now, one of the more famous stories in classic literature is the Count of Monte Cristo. They even made a movie about it, probably more than one. And in this story, a man named Edmond Dantès is betrayed and thrown into prison to advance the romantic, political, and monetary agendas of other men. He escapes from prison, and of course he finds a treasure that gives him, from what you see, limitless wealth. He just never runs out of money. He does these extraordinary things with it. And he begins with that wealth to exact sweet revenge upon his adversaries through this grand scheme. Now, the men who have wronged Edmund are guilty. They have done an evil thing to him. And so Edmund declares multiple times in the novel that he is the hand of divine justice, bringing punishment upon his enemies to teach them that there is a higher power and that justice does exist. And the story resonates, at least at that level, with a lot of what we see in movies and television, because as a culture, we like revenge films. We like the revenge theme. We like the hero who's been really wronged, and he's, you know, it's the sequel, and this time it's personal. You know, it's this thing where we like it when someone, they're justified in doing what they do. And the reason I think we like these things, that we enjoy these things, is deep down, if we're honest, we're all searching for a legitimate reason to avenge ourselves upon another human being. There is a part of me that rejoices when someone has transgressed some kind of social, religious, or legal barrier that now allows me to do what I am otherwise not allowed to do in other circumstances, which is to be cruel to another human being. And so we write people off, we tell people off, we do things to other people, and then we cite their long list of transgressions along the way to justify our own behavior. Why'd you do that? Well, you should hear what they did. And you really see this. I mean, the big taboo thing is to be against same-sex marriage. You do that in our public sphere, and I mean, people, they're coming after you. it's just people that unload both barrels. But we do it too. But what is fascinating about the Count of Monte Cristo is that by the end of the novel, Edmund has completely renounced his plan of vengeance, because he has now seen the collateral damage that he has inflicted, because his plan has resulted in the destruction of innocent lives and the injury of those who had nothing to do with what happened to him, including the death of a young boy. And so at the end of the book, Edmund writes a letter to some of the people that have become his friends throughout the story. And he says this. He says, "Tell the angel who will watch over your future destiny," Morel, the name of his friend, "to pray sometimes for a man who, like Satan, thought himself for an instant equal to God, but who now acknowledges with Christian humility that God alone possesses supreme power and infinite wisdom." The author of this book, Dumas, he got something here that we struggle to accept. Vengeance belongs to God and God alone. I'm just finishing up Deuteronomy this morning, my reading plan, and Moses sings a song, and it's a song. Imagine if I got up here and I said, "Hey, I've got a song for you guys. And it's about you, and it's all about how you're stiff-necked and hard-hearted." That's kind of what Moses' song is about. But in one line in the song, that's where he quotes the famous line where God says, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." Vengeance is mine, God says. Not yours, it's mine. We are not to take justice into our own hands. We are to entrust the authority and legal system that God has sovereignly placed us in. Yes, we seek to mend our legal system, to fix it when it's gone awry, when we can. But when you're the Christians in the early church and there's not exactly a democratic process going on when you're being persecuted and killed, what do you do? What do you do? You entrust yourselves to God. But we are never to take justice into our own hands, for that is presuming to be God ourselves. But rather, as the people of God, we are called to forgive. And that's what we see happening in this text. A radical forgiveness is taking place here. And so this is the theme of the first 15 verses here with Joseph and his brothers. And so remember, we stopped just short of this scene last time. The whole scheme has come just as Joseph wanted it. He had the cup planted on Benjamin, and they were caught. They were brought back, and now Benjamin was going to be made a slave for the prime minister of Egypt, for as far as the brothers knew. And so then Judah comes and gives this stirring speech in which he offers himself in place of his brother. And this is, as we noted last week, is where the whole narrative turns, where Judah offers to substitute himself in place of the guilty party. And so Joseph, as a result of this, as we get into chapter 45, he cannot compose himself anymore. It's the third time that Joseph has a weeping session where he can't control himself. And so so their response to Joseph's testing is the crescendo was Judah's speech. And they have now proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that these men have changed. They are not the same brothers that sold him as a slave 20 years ago. Now, just looking at these first three verses, I mean, you need to really to appreciate, you got to consider the shock that it is for the brothers. Because up to this point, Joseph has spoken only through an interpreter. He's only spoken the Egyptian language. And then he has given the brothers a confusing display of benevolent condescension and harsh treatment. And then he's about to lock up either Benjamin or Judah. One of their brothers is about to become a slave, and who knows what's going to happen to the rest of them. And then suddenly, before the brothers, the prime minister of Egypt suddenly yells something in Egyptian, all his staff leave, and he bursts into uncontrollable sobs. And then, I mean, can you imagine the president? You know, he's doing the press conference or whatever, and he just says, "Everybody get out of here." And he says, just bursts into tears. You know, it's just kind of the thing where he bursts into tears. And then he suddenly speaks for the first time to the brothers in Hebrew. And he says, "I'm Joseph. Is my father alive?" And you can understand why the brothers didn't say anything back. They're just you caught me off guard with that one. Suddenly the pictures and the thoughts of, oh my goodness, what we did to our brother, and now he's standing over us. They're terrified. And Joseph is in complete control. He has all the power. He has all the authority. He could have his brothers imprisoned or killed or sold as slaves. Who's going to stop him? Yet his desire for personal vengeance, it's not even a blip on the radar. It's not even a hint of that in Joseph here. In the Joseph cartoon that my kids have watched, there's this whole scene where it looks like Joseph's going to wreck the vengeance, bring the vengeance, bring the hammer down on the brothers, and suddenly his thoughts are turned. But in reality, the biblical text, vengeance has never seemed to be on his agenda. He seems to have been moving forward and more and more to this moment. What he desires most of all is to be reunited with his family, especially his father and his full brother, Benjamin. But this is no cool, calm, collected moment for Joseph. And when we are in the position to forgive someone who has deeply wounded us, who has hurt us, and to this kind of degree, I mean, none of us can say that we were sold into slavery by our brothers, but we can say, I have been deeply wounded by certain people. There's no way not to be emotional about it. You know, yeah, I forgive you. Oh, we're good. We're good. It's okay. It's an emotional deal. And Joseph is not simply forgiving because he has to, because God said, okay, you two make up. You say you're sorry. You accept it. And then shake hands. Right? That's what we got to do with the kids. He's doing it because he wants to. Because he values reconciliation over vengeance. And if we are truly God's people, then we need to follow in this example and learn to value things as we ought, and to trust God with things that do not belong to us, like vengeance, like settling scores and burying hatchets. Well, that's the right phrase, right? No, having an axe to grind. There we go. Mixing up my cliches. But we see in here that also that in verses 4 through 8 shows us that forgiveness and faith are intertwined. They come as a complete package. Because Joseph, then, they're not saying anything. You make that declaration to somebody and they're not saying anything. And you kind of go and you keep talking. That's me. Someone's just silent. I just keep rambling until to the point of embarrassment. But what Joseph does here is he goes, okay. He says, come quickly. Come closer to me, please. Bites them in. He does that to show them that he's not threatening them. And he also does it because he's got to deal with the elephant in the room. He knows it's on their mind, it's on his mind. So he says, look, I'm Joseph, the one you sold into slavery, the one that you sold into Egypt. He doesn't beat around the bush. He goes straight forward. But then he does the remarkable. He tells them not to be angry with themselves for what they have done. You know, you're just kind of like, not even a little bit. You know, just a little bit, you know, just let me stew a little bit more, you know, just a little bit. Be a little bit upset. Just a little groveling. But no. He forgives them. 20 years. They were going to kill him. And then they sold him. And then the alternative was they sold him into slavery. And then they lied to their father about it. And in that time, Joseph was falsely accused and imprisoned and forgotten in prison. How does someone forgive like that? We have a hard time forgiving for far less, don't we? The reason he can do this is because he knows that God is behind it. Because he has a relationship with a sovereign God who is always in control. Joseph's worldview is so thoroughly grounded in the sovereignty of God that even the greatest act of evil committed against him falls under God's sovereign control. And so God sent Joseph to preserve life. I love that little euphemistic phrase that Joseph used. God sent me here. What was God's method of sending him? Servitude, imprisonment, obscurity, being forgotten. But as Joseph says, this was the means of setting Joseph up over Pharaoh to make him ruler of all the land and to deliver his family from the famine. Verse 7 in the ESV translates it one way as many survivors, but you could actually translate it, and it is this way in some translations, as a great deliverance. That God has sent me here so that he would preserve a remnant and bring a great deliverance. A great deliverance that is composed of many survivors. That's what the great deliverance is. What was the great deliverance out of Egypt during the time of the Exodus? It was the survivors out of Egypt. That's why the Hebrew word for deliverance is connected with the word survivor. What this means is that it takes trust in a sovereign God to forgive. And a practical reason for this is because there is no way to recover what you have lost when someone sins against you grievously. There's no way that Joseph can recover the 20 years that he lost. There's no way when someone has sinned against you in a certain way and it's years back, it affected your life for years on end. You can't go back. I mean, what are you going to do to get payment out of that person? Can they wind the clock back? Can they give you your time back? Can they give you your life? They can't do it. They can't pay the debt. It's too great. But what we see here in Joseph are 20 hard years sown so that what we have now is a harvest of blessing. In a sermon on one of the Psalms, Tim Keller, he talked about sowing our tears. And in that we entrust our sorrows and our hardships to the sovereign God, trusting that it will yield a harvest in His kingdom one day. But it's not just sowing tears. Sometimes we have to sow our years. Years of sorrow, turmoil, heartache, pain. Sometimes that we don't see no end. Sometimes we're Psalm 88 people, where it just closes out with "Darkness is my only friend." And you just, sometimes that's where some people's life has ended. Sometimes we're the William Cooper. Who's written so many wonderful hymns that we sing, who I personally believe was a Christian, but personally he died without any sense of assurance of his salvation. Sometimes that's where we end. It takes a faith that trusts in the sovereign God that we're going to, because what do we say about those Christians that died in persecution? What do we say about the Christians that are dying now in persecution? What do we say to the people and even in our own country that are in the midst of hardship and turmoil? And it's long term and it's unrelenting. You cannot just go to people and say, "Don't chin up, it'll get better." Because what happens when it doesn't? What happens when, you know, you say that, you know, the light comes when just when it's about to get dark, and it's like, what happens when it's just about to get dark, just turns pitch black? That's when we need the sovereign God. Now, we're going to talk more about this later, because the brothers are going to struggle with the forgiveness that Joseph has given them. But for now, we need to see that it is a trust in a sovereign God that enables us to forgive even the deepest wrongs, because we know that the sovereign God can work even the most painful things to our good and to His glory. But also notice in verses 9 through 15 that forgiveness results in action, because Joseph doesn't simply forgive his brothers and send them off. He could have done it. He says, "You sinned against me, I forgive you, and as proof of that, I'm not going to kill you. I'm not going to put you into servitude. Here's your food. You paid for it. Take it and go. You know, may God's face shine upon you. I'll see you next year, Thanksgiving." You know, and so it just kind of, he could have done that. But no, what does he do? He says, no, they need something from me. I've got to provide. They have needs that I've got to meet. And so he goes further. He invites them. He practically commands them. He says, "Please come to Egypt so I can care for you." And sometimes forgiveness requires action on the part of the one who has been sinned against. And so Joseph provides. He puts out the invitation there. And he needs to provide. Now the second half of this, the rest of this chapter, verses 16 through 36, it really kind of focuses on the idea of kind of the response to this act of forgiveness that Joseph has done. And so we see it here with Pharaoh, which is somebody who was not involved with this conflict at all. You ever been on, you know, the third party and there's, you know, people are shooting missiles at each other, you know, relationally wise, and you're just standing over here and you're like, I'm glad I'm over here. You know, I'm out here. You know, and so you just kind of, you see that you're just outside of the conflict. Well, Pharaoh hears about what's going on. He hears that his brothers have come and Sproul's, you know, he speculated that Pharaoh's probably heard the story about how Joseph came to be, you know, and so, what does Pharaoh do? Well, he rejoices. He encourages them in it. He says, hey, you know what? Yeah, everybody come up here. I'll tell you what. I'm going to send the limos down to go get everybody. Wagons. I'm sending my fleet of limos down to go get everybody. And you don't even need to bring anything, because the best we got is yours. Leave it. I mean, you ever thought about that? You know, somebody came to you and said, hey, you need to move over here. And you know what? Just leave all the stuff in your house, because everything we got better than what you got. And it's yours. You wouldn't be able to believe it. You wouldn't believe it. That's what he's saying. And so when those of us, those who are near us, are pursuing reconciliation, then we should encourage them in it. We should provide in any way that we can to help enable that to continue to happen. Whether it's, you know, yeah, you all come meet at my place. Yeah, I'll help you do that. I'll cover for you so you can go do this or whatever it is. We should do those things. Try to encourage that to happen. Now take a look at verses 21 and 24. It's interesting because you see the forgiver who is providing, but you see the forgiver who has to give even more. Because you see what Joseph does here. Because he adds on more and more to what he's doing for several reasons. But sometimes we who are the forgiving party, we have to go even further than the one who is forgiven. And sometimes they need assurance that we have actually forgiven them. Other times they may have needs that need to be met. But our work is not done by simply exchanging verbal words of forgiveness. We must go further than this. And so Joseph gives them the wagons. He gives them the provisions. Then on top of that, he gives each of them a change of clothes. But Benjamin, he gets 5 changes of clothes and a wad of cash. Now here, you need to notice what's going on here. Because think about this. Joseph was sold for 20 pieces of silver. And he lost his clothes. They were taken from him. And here he gives all of his brother's clothes plus a small fortune to his youngest brother. Commentators said that essentially he is making reparation for what they did. He's making what they did right. He was sold for pieces of silver. He just gave them 300 to the youngest brother, because he was the youngest brother who was sold for silver. And finally, he encourages them not to argue with each other, to kick themselves as they're going down, or anything else that would hinder them or take away from the present state of joy. Sometimes doesn't it feel worse to be forgiven than to have the person mad at you? Because sometimes you feel forgiven. Man, I just feel awful because they're forgiving me and they're not mad at me. They're not sinning against me. It's a lot easier if they're sinning against me to justify myself. But if they've forgiven me, it's a lot harder. Sometimes it feels that way. But there's no room for finger pointing or arguments, for everything has been forgiven. All that remains is to carry the forgiveness forward. The Jewish commentator Robert Alter, he even argues that Joseph is actually reassuring his brothers that they don't need to fear any lurking residue of vengefulness on his part. Saying there's not an inkling of that here. Don't worry about me. You're good. In verses 25 to 28, we see the effect of this forgiveness. Now, they're going back home. And R.C. Sproul pointed this out. He said, they're going back home. And they're going to come home. They're going to tell their dad, hey, Joseph's in Egypt. What's the next question? How'd he get there? That's a funny story, actually. Yeah. You know that torn coat thing? Quite what happened. So, minor detail change. We need to clear that up. But then they got to fess up to what they did. And when Jacob hears the report, he grows numb. Some translate this rightly as his heart stopped. That the Hebrew word here actually gives the picture of a hand that suddenly just does this. You just shut down. You didn't even know what to do with that. And he can't believe it. And this is something I think we understand this because the door for that hope for his son was closed long ago. We know people like this. We've been in this position ourselves where someone says, there's a truth that comes across in your word and you're like, I want that to be true, don't bring that to me right now. I don't even know what to do with that. That is rekindling hope in me that I have let die. That's not even in my realm of reality anymore. And suddenly, it's all back. And Jacob just shuts down. All Jacob wanted was Benjamin. That's all he wanted. And now he finds out Joseph's alive. But he can't believe it. But then when he hears the account in detail, this is why Joseph said, Benjamin, hey, he focused on Benjamin right at the end. He said, Benjamin, hey, you've seen it in my mouth. You can verify, I'm your brother. It's my mouth that's giving you these words, because that's Benjamin's got he's the seal of approval. The favored son of Jacob is the seal of approval on the report of these brothers. And so he hears the account in detail. He sees the wagons. He sees the donkeys. He sees all the stuff. And it says he is revived, that he has come to life again, as it were. And then he declares, it's enough. I believe it. I'll go. The forgiveness of the brothers by Joseph restores his relationship with his brothers. It brings them together again. But the effect of that forgiveness of Joseph on his brothers is not limited to simply him and his brothers. It revives his own father and stirs him to make one final journey, the last journey Jacob will ever make alive, because they'll carry his bones back to his resting place. Now, ultimately, what you have here is a foreshadowing of Christ. It's a picture, a scene. Jesus, the favorite son of the Father, the only son of the Father, who came, he lived a perfect life, he was betrayed by his brothers, his friends, his disciples, for 30 pieces of silver. His clothes were torn from him, he was falsely accused and murdered. And then he rose again. And now he sits at the right hand of God the Father Almighty, with all power, with all authority. And what does he do with us? To we who have rebelled against him from birth, to we who were the cause of his bloody death, of his humiliation, he forgives us fully, completely, to the uttermost. He provides not only everything we need in this life, as Peter tells us in one of his letters, but also for the next. I mean, isn't that what death is all about for the Christian? You leave your stuff there, Because we got better stuff over here. Jesus is preparing a place for us. Wasn't it amazing when he showed up to those dismal, floundering disciples who were afraid and who had locked themselves in a room? He shows up and they're freaked out, understandably. And he says, come closer. Come closer. I'm real. I'm real. He even encourages one of them to look at his wounds, to touch them, and to see that he is truly alive. Then later in that famous scene where he takes Peter aside, Mr. Bold, Mr. Denier, and restores him. May we look to Jesus and see this forgiving Savior. May we understand that our sin against God is far worse than the brothers committed against Joseph. May we see this forgiving Savior who has restored us, who provides for us, and calls us to life, who revives us. When you see that, when you have that, then you don't need revenge. Because we've got something better. Forgiveness. We have been forgiven all our sins. And so as God's people, we are now free to forgive those who sin against us. Let's pray.